The headlines: Iran's foreign minister says the JCPOA was the outcome of years of intense negotiations and does not need any change. The Yemeni army says it has launched yet another retaliatory attack on Saudi Arabia, this time hitting Abha Airport and a military base with drones. And Australian women hold rallies against gender inequality in the wake of a recent wave of allegations of sexual assault in Parliament. Hello and welcome everybody here in the Iranian capital Tehran. This is World News. Our top story for this half hour: the Iranian foreign minister has once again called on the United States to move fast with regards to saving the 2015 nuclear deal. Mohammad Javad Zarif calls the JCPOA the best possible deal that could ever be reached.
The United States has to come clean. We will not play with the future of our nation. U.S. needs to come clean. U.S. cannot play with us. We are serious negotiators, but when we agree to something, we stick to it, and we have shown that. We have an agreement. I can tell you one thing. This administration, the next administration, will not be able to do a better deal with Iran. Not with this government, not with any future government. This was the best deal possible.
Zarif was addressing a virtual conversation organized by the European Policy Center. He said Iran needs serious trust in the ability of Europe and the U.S. to speak to their commitments. He said the Iranian nation has otherwise learned how to insulate the economy from oil and how to immunize it from coercion. He said the administration of President Joe Biden has done nothing new, rather recently threatening to block Iranian assets in South Korea. The top diplomat reiterated that the JCPOA was the outcome of years of intense negotiations and does not need any change. Zarif said the deal, as emphasized by the leader of the Islamic Revolution, was a test which the U.S. failed by pulling out of it in 2018. Iran has called on the International Atomic Energy Agency to maintain impartiality and make comments based on technical matters. Foreign Ministry spokesman Said Khatibzadeh says the issue of the supervision of Iran's nuclear program is a technical matter. He says Tehran has provided access to the IAEA according to the safeguards agreement. He made a comment following recent remarks by the agency's Secretary General Rafael Grossi, had earlier said the IAEA was seeking more inspection of Iran's activities following Tehran's enrichment of uranium at higher levels. IRGC chief commander has warned the enemies about threatening Iran, saying that Iran's defense is progressing steadily. Major General Hossein Salami said despite sanctions, Iran's defensive power has developed in line with the latest technologies. He particularly hailed the homegrown electronic warfare of Iranian forces, saying that progress will give the IRGC upper hand in dealing with enemies. General Salami made the remarks at a ceremony of delivering new missile systems to IRGC Navy on Monday. Yemeni armed forces say they launched fresh drone attacks on two targets inside Saudi Arabia. Earlier we talked to our Sana'a correspondent Abdul Latif Al-Washami, who gave us more details about these attacks. Let's hear what they have to say.
The Yemeni army has carried out a new operation today. We talk military attack against Saudi Arabia. Three drones of Qassam K2 has targeted Abha International Airport and King Khalid Air Base. The drones have accurately hit the target, according to the spokesperson of the Yemeni army, Yahya Sariya. These attacks are in conjunction with the continued escalation against Marib. The escalation is not against only Saudi Arabia and Saudi facilities. It's also against the last stronghold of Saudi Arabia in northern Yemen. The Yemeni army continues its operations against the city. 80% of Marib is liberated, according to military sources. And we may enter a new level of retaliatory attacks that was called by the Yemeni army the Great Pain in a few days if the war on siege continues.
Australian women hold nationwide rallies to call for gender equality and justice for victims of sexual assault. Thousands of women gathered in front of the Parliament building in the capital city of Canberra. Women also hit the streets in more than 40 cities and towns. The protests were sparked by a recent wave of allegations of sexual assault and discrimination in some of Australia's highest political offices, including the parliament. The government has ordered an independent inquiry into parliament's workplace culture. But critics say systemic change is needed. Political commentator Tim Anderson says sexual harassment and gender discrimination are deeply rooted in the culture of the Australian society.
I think it's a deep-rooted cultural thing, you know, because this is the underlying reality here also is a range of scandals about sexual assault in schools and in universities, an ongoing thing, and colleges at universities. And it's often brushed under the carpet and not taken seriously. And I think that has been building up for some time, that sort of anger. So there's a deep cultural concern. In the particular cases, of course, there has been an inquiry into the High Court judge. There are calls now for the inquiry into the Attorney General. So, you know, there are particular circumstances where particular actions might be taken, but we are talking about a very deep cultural problem here, and it's something that the current government seems incapable of addressing properly.
A video showing the 2011 massacre of an Afghan family by the British Army's Special Forces has reportedly gone missing. A member of the Afghan family has filed a lawsuit at the UK High Court. This is not the first time a key evidence of a deadly raid has gone missing. In our news review program, we discuss the issue with our guests. Let's take a listen. Hello and welcome to the News Review, where we look deeper into some of the top stories of the day. A video showing the 2011 massacre of an Afghan family by a special forces unit of the British Army has gone missing. That's according to a media report citing a court document. A case was filed at the UK High Court by Saifullah Yar, then in his 20s, when four of his family members were shot dead. The case heightened concerns that British forces were massacring civilians with no connection to the Taliban. The video of that raid was captured by the U.S. military, but according to the Sunday Times, American authorities mysteriously lost the footage. It's not the first time key evidence of a deadly raid goes missing. UK investigators tasked with probing war crimes in 2017 found that British operators doctored reports on dozens of such raids between 2011 and 2013. Joining us on this edition of the News Review, we have lecturer at Coventry University, Kenneth Farrow, joining us from London. Also, author and commentator John Stepling joining us from Inderøy, Norway. Mr. Farrow, give us your thoughts on this video now going missing.
More recently, of course, since about 2001, in the so-called attempt to deal with the war on terror, the British and UK governments launched their own war of terror on the people of Afghanistan. And this is just one incident in that terrible history of UK involvement. The reasons for all this, of course, we have to remember not just around military conflicts, but in terms of the resources in Afghanistan. We know that recently over $1 trillion US dollars of lithium and gold were found in Ghazi province. And these are the kind of issues that are behind these attempts to cover up the crimes of British soldiers. We know that British special forces have been having kill or capture death squad raids in Afghanistan during the conflict since 2001. And the attempt to have this inquiry by the AIHRC in Afghanistan has to be welcomed and supported. But there's no surprise this evidence has gone missing. Historically, not just in Afghanistan, but in other conflicts, evidence goes missing. Witnesses suddenly decide not to give evidence. And it's just the way that the British state has historically and currently tries to cover up the crimes which its troops and its officers commit.
John Stepling in Inderøy, give us your thoughts as well. Mr. Kenneth Farrell believes obviously this is a cover-up. Share with us your thoughts, not only about the conduct of the British forces, but about the Americans as well.
Your other guest mentioned this has gone on for quite a while. There were accusations all the way back to 2003, I think, something else. There was a case about 52 civilians that were massacred by SAS troops, and I think that was 2017. There have been accusations leveled at Australian special forces for massacring unarmed civilians, including children. And when one of those soldiers was interviewed, he said, well, we're just imitating what the Americans and Brits are doing and getting away with. And so everybody knows this. I mean, it's very interesting that the emails were that were taken from British soldiers in that region after this particular incident seemed to indicate that this was nothing out of the ordinary. They said things like, oh, they're going out on another killing spree. And it becomes a killing competition. And there was one case, an especially grotesque case, in which a room full of children were machine gunned to death, four children ages 4 to 11, who were then discovered by their father. Another one were two 14-year-old boys who had done nothing except maybe be sympathetic to the Taliban. And they had their throats cut. They were bagged and thrown in the river. But this is not an anomaly. Armies of occupation do this, and the U.S. has a long history of doing this. Certainly they did it in Vietnam. They have supported and trained the death squads for dictators like Papa Doc and those in Guatemala and El Salvador. So this is, all of this kind of hand-wringing and clutching of pearls and mock outrage as if this is something new. It's not new. And it begs the question why any of these countries, Western colonial powers, imperialist powers, are in that region at all. They've been there for hundreds of years, of course, and now with Africa, they're returning under guise of controlling food systems. It's the new scramble for Africa. That colonialist mindset just has never gone away, and this is... this is more evidence of it. This is just one example of it, and it's this particular case, Mr. Yar's case, is not particularly acute or egregious. It's just the one that has made it this far. The fact that they got rid of the videotape is—I'd have been surprised if they didn't get rid of it. Of course, they got rid of it. And that's what they do. They have the power, and they're the occupying force. And the other comment that your guest made that's quite worth noting and underscoring is, yeah, there are a lot of minerals in this region. The U.S. and U.K. are not leaving anytime soon. They intend to stay there, and that's why they keep building permanent bases there.
All right, thanks a lot, gentlemen. Kenneth Farrow joining us from London, John Stepling joining us from Inderøy, Norway. With that, it brings us to an end here on this edition of News Review. Moving on, German Chancellor Angela Merkel's Conservative Party has suffered heavy losses in two key regional elections. Media estimations show Merkel's Christian Democratic Union Party has scored its worst ever results in two southwestern states that were considered conservative strongholds. In Baden-Württemberg, a surging Green Party has taken the lead in neighboring Rhineland-Palatinate state. The left-leaning Social Democrats are projected to retain power. CDU members say the coronavirus pandemic has triggered their poor results.
The CDU and other parties could not get their programs presented, and that made the campaigning very difficult. It was campaigning in extraordinary times with an extraordinary result. And we will analyze all the external and internal influences, such as coronavirus and the mask scandal. But those are internal issues, and internally, I can also state very clearly that the CDU remains strong despite the developments of the past weeks.
Officials from CDU's Bavarian sister party, CSU, described the results as a wake-up call, saying Germany's largest bloc needs to win back public trust. The Sunday regional elections are seen as an indication of what might happen in Germany's September general elections when Merkel's successor will be chosen. Her government has faced criticism in recent months, partly because of a sluggish COVID-19 vaccination program and a mask procurement scandal. Italy reimposes coronavirus restrictions across much of the country to contain a spike in virus cases. Restrictions affect three-quarters of Italy and are effective until April the 6th. The measures include closure of schools, shops, and restaurants, as well as movement restrictions. The government hopes the ongoing vaccinations and strict measures help contain the new wave that is fueled by the UK variant of the virus. Italy has so far recorded more than 3.2 million infections. The country has also registered over 100,000 coronavirus deaths. That is Europe's second highest tally after the UK. The Palestinian authorities ordered a five-day lockdown in the occupied West Bank amid a surge in coronavirus cases. Pumano Kandil has more in this report from Ramallah.
Hospitals across the occupied West Bank are full, and intensive care units operating at over 100% capacity as the number of the coronavirus patients in some cities are growing significantly. A new field hospital is set to open near occupied city of Ramallah, and some parks will be converted to field hospitals as well in an attempt to cope with the new wave of infections. Palestinian Health Minister May Al-Kayla said earlier that the West Bank is facing a third wave of the pandemic. The Palestinian government has imposed new restrictions, including the closure of schools and universities, but it seems that measures have failed to quell rising infections among the Palestinians.
This situation is very difficult. It can be described as an unprecedented coronavirus cases spike. We were hoping not to open field hospitals, but to witness an end to this virus. After recommendations from Health Directorate and the Ministry of Health, there is an urgent need for a serious position from all the Palestinians. After 1 year, they should completely abide by the measures.
People of the West Bank demand the Palestinian Authority to import vaccines. However, the PA has managed to acquire only a few thousand doses of vaccines, not even enough for frontline health workers. As observers say, the gap between Israel and the Palestinians has illustrated the global inequity between rich and poor nations in terms of access to vaccines. UN officials and human rights groups have expressed concerns over the disparity, saying Israel is an occupying power that is responsible for the well-being of the Palestinians.
1 year on, the COVID-19 still rages on in the occupied West Bank, with hospitals filled up amid shortage of medical equipment. This has led the Palestinian Authority to adopt new measures, including strict lockdown, to cope with the new wave of the pandemic. Mona Kandib, Occupied Ramallah.
And that brings us to an end here on this edition of the World News. Do stay tuned, though. Bye.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Leaked documents expose how major news outlets like the BBC and Reuters were contracted by the British government to push an anti-Russian narrative and further British interests inside Russia and in its neighboring countries. Many of these materials were marked confidential by Her Majesty's government, hoping they'd never see the light of day and that no one would publicly scrutinize them. Well, that's exactly what we're going to do. I'm Richard Medhurst, and this is The Communique. For several years now, we've constantly heard allegations in the media of how Russia has been spreading fake news and disinformation and manipulating social media sites and running troll farms and even journalists to meddle in the political affairs of the United States, the United Kingdom, and their allies. Well, it turns out the United Kingdom has been doing precisely that to Russia. A little hypocritical, don't you think? In a package of leaked documents posted online by the hacker collective Anonymous, we learn how Britain's Foreign Ministry, the Foreign and Commonwealth Office, or FCO, sought to spread anti-Russian propaganda and promote narratives that were favorable to Britain and its allies. Under the FCO's Counter-Disinformation and Media Development Program, the British government issued this invitation to tender, offering millions of pounds for contractors to allegedly develop a, quote, network of NGOs exposing disinformation, unquote. Stated as part of the program's broader goal is to weaken Russian influence in neighboring countries. One of the parties that responded with a bid is the Zinc Network, a collective which includes organizations like Bellingcat and the Institute for Statecraft. Bellingcat has previously denied receiving any funding or information from the British Foreign and Commonwealth Office, yet here we see Bellingcat bidding for a contract from none other than the FCO. And in 2018, they pushed this narrative, which the UK, France, and the US used as a pretext, as a justification to go and bomb Syria. How bizarre. These leaked documents also go on to show how BBC Media Action and the Reuters Thomson Foundation, which are supposed to be the non-profit charities of BBC and Reuters respectively, were also awarded contracts by the Foreign and Commonwealth Office. Despite the original announcement by the FCO stating that the program is supposedly open and no attempt should be made to disguise activity, the contract with Reuters, for example, clearly says otherwise and is marked confidential, as are many other documents, which seems a bit odd if you're allegedly trying to promote journalistic standards and ethics to be participating in a secret program with the British government. These documents show how all these various outlets were telling the FCO about the thousands of journalists and contacts that they possess across the world, as if they're somehow boasting how far they can spread propaganda on behalf of Her Majesty's government. This propaganda is a spiderweb, frankly, of synthetic media groups and fronts for British intelligence. And you may recall some of these names, some of these groups like Albany or perhaps the Integrity Initiative, which were also implicated in the British government's propaganda network against Syria, aiming to promote regime change through all these fronts like ARC and IncoStrat, who were also running the White Helmets. Yes, it's a lot to digest, and it's done that way on purpose so that no one knows what's going on and everything remains obfuscated. These news outlets, like Reuters and the BBC, they claim to have an independent editorial board and to be transparent and objective. Yet when it comes to their supposed nonprofits, I mean, there's nothing ethical going on here. Anyone could agree that all of these shady practices have nothing to do with upholding journalistic standards, to say the least. It's interesting to see how the British government is doing exactly what it's been accusing Russia of doing for years. Russophobia has always been an effective political tool, you know, accusing someone of working for the Russians or being a communist in order to smear them. This goes back to the days of the Cold War and the Red Scare and McCarthyism. However, ever since the 2016 U.S. presidential elections, when Donald Trump beat the D.C. establishment favorite, Hillary Clinton, we've heard nonstop whining from the media and politicians in the United States about this made-up Russian interference, Russiagate. And after Trump won, exorbitant amounts of time and resources were wasted on trying to prove that there was some kind of link between his campaign and Russia with the Mueller report and various other congressional reports that amounted to absolutely nothing. And this is not just in the United States, of course. This is also something that transpired and was carried over into the UK on the other side of the pond. This craze of supposed Russian meddling and disinformation also took root there. And that's no surprise. Wherever the United States goes, the UK follows. We saw former Prime Minister Theresa May decry alleged Russian interference in Britain's elections. They claimed the Russians had interfered in Brexit. They claimed the Russians had interfered in Britain's general elections, in the Scottish referendum even. And just like in the United States, the British government went and started various inquiries, providing an official stamp of approval on its conspiracy theory to blame Russia. Max Blumenthal published an article on the investigative journalism website, The Gray Zone, unpacking the contents of these leaked documents, the stated purposes, goals, and actors involved in these anti-Russian propaganda networks that were cooked up by the British government. And if the contents weren't explosive enough, the article garnered even more attention after Twitter put a warning label underneath anyone who posted it, stating that it may contain hacked materials, as if to say that it were somehow hazardous and to disincentivize people from reading it. Another clear attempt at censorship just because the article, the story, doesn't suit the narratives of Western governments. How surprising. Now, the hypocrisy, frankly, couldn't be clearer. You know, one need only look at other news stories involving leaked documents from other governments, particularly in countries the UK and the US do not like, which received no warning label from Twitter. You can go and post them right now. There will be no warning on them. And just recently, for example, The Intercept published a story which supposedly included leaked documents from the Chinese government. There's no warning label on their tweet when they share the article. We don't even know if these documents are real. It doesn't matter. They can post them without any form of censorship or impediment. The Intercept has also published alleged documents containing hacked cables from Iran. Is there any so-called fact-checking to check if they're real? Or if they are real, was there any warning label on them about hacked materials? Of course not. It's so evident that these big tech and social media giants, who are a main source of news for many Americans and Westerners, they have a double standard. They want to enjoy the privilege of being treated as a platform so that they can't be held accountable for anything people post there, while also performing the activities of a publisher who picks and chooses what to release. And not only that, they also apply another double standard towards news stories that are adversarial to governments that the West is at odds with, while limiting and censoring journalists that question Western narratives and imperialism. Max Blumenthal, journalist and founder of The Gray Zone, who unpacked the contents of these latest FCO leaks, showing how the British government contracted media outlets to sow anti-Russian dissent and pro-NATO sentiment, joins me now to talk more. Thanks for coming on the show, Max. Good to have you on.
Thanks for inviting me on.
So, Max, I'll start out with the obvious one here. You know, we've been told for years that it's Russia who's meddling in other countries and in Western democracies and their affairs. And you look at these FCO documents, and turns out everything they accused Russia, they're doing. What do these documents tell us exactly?
Yeah, you said it perfectly. The British state, which really is acting as this sort of frontline proxy for Washington here in the new Cold War containment strategy against Russia, is doing everything that it accuses Russia of doing. This is all confirmed. We have the hard details, and this is only a scintilla of what it's probably doing. This is just what we know. And there are hundreds of documents here. I focused on the ones that revealed Reuters through its charitable nonprofit arm, the Thomson Reuters Foundation, and the BBC through its nonprofit arm, BBC Media Action, as well as smaller self-styled independent outlets like Bellingcat and Medusa as essentially intelligence contractors for the British Foreign Office. And, you know, if you look at the whole scope of the documents, they're all focused on trying to counter and squelch Russian media that supports the national interests of the Russian government and the Russian state. And they're focused not only internally inside Russia, but also in Russia's near abroad in the Baltics, Ukraine, Central Asia. They're using not only smaller media outlets and these major media organizations like Reuters, which is the largest media organization in the world. They're also creating family-oriented theatrical events in public parks in the Baltics, or soap opera, TV dramas, all sorts of programming to weaponize their media prowess, funded all by the British Foreign Office, to basically hack the brains of the Russian-speaking population within Russia's sphere of influence and affect attitudinal changes. We constantly saw these phrases in the documents, attitudinal changes to make them more pro-NATO. So what Reuters focused on was Russian journalists and bringing Russian journalists over to the UK, funded by the British Foreign Office through tours, and it was all kind of covert. The contracts that I published at the Gray Zone, they're marked secret, confidential, classified.
Yeah. They're engaging in secrecy. There's a covert element to what they're doing, right? They're trying to hide what's going on. And I mean, isn't that a bit odd considering they're allegedly promoting unbiased journalism and ethics?
Well, in the 60s and 70s, Reuters ran a program for the MI6, British Foreign Intelligence, to produce anti-Soviet media in Latin America and to brand it as kind of independent. It was exposed because the documents were declassified, and Reuters came out and said, we don't do this anymore. This was all in the past. It was a Cold War thing. We refer you to our trust principles, which pledge independence and editorial integrity. And what these documents show here is that they are doing the same exact thing, the same program is in play, and that they've lied. So they have worked to keep these programs secret. One document reveals Thomson Reuters, in its bid to the British Foreign Office, describing how well it kept secret a delegation of Russian journalists to the UK during the Sergei Skripal poisoning intrigue. and they said, Reuters said, we were coordinating constantly with the British embassy in Moscow to keep this under wraps. And as I mentioned, the contracts between Reuters and the British Foreign Office are marked private and confidential. So they obviously didn't want the British public to know that they're doing this. They certainly don't want the Russian government or Russian public to know about this. And they boast about creating a network of 400 journalists inside Russia. And I mean, this is just the tip of the iceberg of what these documents reveal.
So, I mean, if you recall in 2020, YouTube said it's going to be banning videos that contain hacked materials. And, you know, Twitter is citing this hacked materials policy when they censored the Hunter Biden story by the New York Post and locked their account. And now this term hacked materials resurfaces as a label under your article. Where do you think they're going with this ultimately?
Well, just straight up censorship. With the Twitter label, what so many young people saw who are ideologically unmoored was that somebody who just simply went out and told the truth got soft censored. And what they see with Julian Assange, if they learn about that, is that someone who simply went out and published true facts was tortured and disappeared. So the idea that we have this liberal society where the truth can prevail and that the society can still be resilient enough and maintain its own national security and advance its national interests while there is a free discourse and citizens are able to criticize their government, that whole veneer has been completely ripped off by these episodes. And it just gets, it's like an onion that just keeps getting peeled away and peeled away until we reach the core, which is just this rotten, festering orb of cynicism and crude, raw power. And I think we're very close to that core right now.
Max Blumenthal, thank you so much for your time. It's great having you on. We'll be right back after this short break.
Communique is a program in which Richard Medhurst, the independent journalist and political commentator, gives his views of controversial issues of our time and interviews famous politicians and personalities. This program is broadcast by IRIB English Radio.
Chris Williamson, former member of parliament and close ally of Jeremy Corbyn, attempted to scrutinize these very same programs, particularly the Institute for Statecraft and its integrity initiative, after it targeted Jeremy Corbyn, the leader of the Labour Party at the time, smearing him as a, quote, useful idiot from Moscow, unquote. As a member of parliament, he submitted a question to Alan Duncan, who at the time was the deputy to Foreign Secretary Boris Johnson. Williamson was inquiring about the nature of these programs, but was stonewalled repeatedly on grounds of national security. Chris joins me now. Thanks for taking the time to come on the show.
No, thanks for inviting me back, Richard. Good to be here.
So, Chris, we've been hearing for years now that it's Russia that's, you know, running all these disinformation campaigns and meddling in the U.S. and U.K. affairs. And it seems now from these FCO leaks that we're doing that in other countries. As a matter of fact, to Russia specifically. I mean, isn't that a bit, you know, hypocritical of us?
Very hypocritical. And I think the political class and the establishment in Britain are guilty of hypocrisy and hyperbole in equal measure. And, you know, Russia may very well be seeking to promote its interests through engaging in an information war. I don't know. There's, as I say, a lot of hyperbole about it. But what is absolutely certain is that we know that the Foreign and Commonwealth Office are engaged in a very significant information war effort, aided and abetted by the so-called independent British Broadcasting Corporation and, of course, Reuters, the biggest media organisation anywhere in the world. And, you know, this goes against the kind of whole ethos, allegedly, of Reuters, who, when they were exposed after papers were revealed under the kind of 30-year rule when cabinet papers are put into the public domain, and it came out that they'd been working hand in glove with the British state to, you know, engage in a propaganda offensive against the former Soviet Union, They were, you know, very apologetic about that and regretful and said, you know, this goes against our ethos and we certainly don't do anything like that today. And yet we now know from this latest revelations that precisely what they are doing. And it's pretty shocking, really. And, you know, it just sort of shows the real double standards that are at play here.
So, Chris, there's a video of you in 2019 when you were trying to uncover what's going on. You went and confronted, actually, the Institute for Statecraft at their headquarters in London and even went to Scotland. Can you tell us what you found out about the Institute for Statecraft, their integrity initiative, and, you know, how the government was essentially trying to stonewall you and block you from finding out what was going on?
Yeah, well, I mean, when the kind of hacktivist group Anonymous put a lot of documents into the public domain which exposed the activities of the Institute for Statecraft and one of their projects called the Integrity Initiative, I started asking questions because, within those papers it was revealed that they were engaged in a propaganda offensive against the leader of the Labour Party and some other key figures at a senior level inside the party, which at that time, of course, was promoting a socialist program at home and an anti-imperialist agenda in terms of its foreign policy. And of course, this was unconscionable to the establishment, to the military-industrial complex, to the Zionist lobby. And so there were a lot of powerful forces obviously ranged against it. And so I started to ask some questions because it became apparent from these papers that they were attacking Jeremy Corbyn, smearing him, using social media platforms to do that, and discovered through a series of parliamentary questions that the Foreign Commonwealth Office and the Ministry of Defence had awarded the Institute for Statecraft and its Integrity Initiative in the previous 18 months alone in excess of £2 million. However, when I sought to get further information about their activities, they clammed up and said that this would undermine the effectiveness of the programme, citing national security and a whole manner of other ridiculous excuses. So I then took it upon myself to try and find out a little bit more information directly from the organisation and went to Scotland to their registered office, only to find that it's a semi-derelict former paper mill at the end of a half-mile dirt track. I mean, you couldn't make it up, really. They do have offices in London, and as you mentioned, I did go and try to seek some information from the people there. And a chap who, one of the founders of the Institute for Statecraft, Dan Lafayette, opened the door to me. And when I introduced myself and said I was Chris Williamson, MP for Derby North, and got some questions about their activities, he unceremoniously slammed the door in my face. I did try to shout a few questions through the closed door. And the thing about the Institute for Statecraft is that they have a range of what they refer to as clusters, journalists, tame journalists and academics, not just in Britain, but throughout Europe and around the world. And their alleged aim is to counter, you know, Russian disinformation. But it is interesting that, you know, this outfit is getting that level of support and the involvement of the BBC and, as I've said, Reuters. It seems very, very troubling, and it's just the double standards which gets me. Russia is held up as this bogeyman, and yet the UK is engaged in far more intense sort of information war activities than anything that Russia's ever done, and I just think that's really worrying.
So these government programs, I mean, they're not just for foreign affairs in Russia, its neighboring countries, in Syria, but also at home in the UK, right? Because if they were smearing Jeremy Corbyn, the former Labour leader and leader of the opposition, you know, that means they're going after dissidents or opponents or people they don't like or people who are considered perhaps anti-establishment inside the UK, right?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, certainly that was one of the main reasons why, of course, I started to ask questions about what their activities, because they were using public money to attack the leader of the official opposition in the UK. And, that is an attack on our democracy, it seems to me. And that's why I was calling for a public inquiry. But, of course, you see, the agenda that Jeremy Corbyn was spearheading was one which threatened the status quo. It threatened the huge profits that were being made from the military industry, the defence industry in this country. And of course, it threatened the sort of foreign policy of Britain, the kind of consensus that there's been amongst parties, both parties, really ever since the war in terms of its attitude towards Israel. But we had in Jeremy Corbyn somebody who was a very strong anti-imperialist, somebody who was a big supporter of the Palestinian cause, somebody who had, criticized the Israeli state, the Israeli regime, demanded that they comply with their international law obligations, and therefore he was, it seemed to me, seen as a legitimate target, because that would have indeed called into question the UK's role in supporting Israel and supporting the hugely profitable arms industry in this regime. That obviously was something that they weren't prepared to countenance. And of course it went further than that, because Jeremy was somebody, and the agenda that he was putting forward, of course, gave us hope that we could turn the page on the neoliberal consensus that has caused so much despair and created so much poverty in Britain, the fifth biggest economy in the world, where we have 14 million people living in poverty. And had that opportunity, I think, over time, the Labour government led by Jeremy Corbyn would have indeed done that. And that's why I think they targeted him. They targeted him because of his domestic policy and obviously his foreign policy. These were things which were very powerful vested interests that couldn't be allowed to stand. And they did everything they could, therefore, to stop them, including using public money to go after, as I say, the leader of the official opposition in the country. As I say, this goes to the root, it goes to the core of what our democracy is supposed to be about. I mean, it's almost incredible. If you read it in a screenplay before these documents came into the public domain, you'd say, well, that's all very interesting, but it would never happen in real life. But of course, often truth is stranger than fiction, and here's a case in point.
The hypocrisy of the British government and these supposed NGOs and news outlets that they've cooperated with is frankly stunning. They claim to be fighting disinformation while spreading disinformation themselves. It's just plain old propaganda. And no less from establishments like the BBC and Reuters and others who claim to be superior and claim to uphold journalistic standards. For years, we've heard nothing but anti-Russian propaganda from these very same outlets, and fear-mongering about Russian interference from lawmakers on both sides of the pond, and virtually every mainstream media outlet reporting that as fact. And yet, now, when we have a story of the exact same caliber with official government documents proving that the United Kingdom has been doing the exact same thing, complete silence. The media can't even be bothered to report on these explosive revelations of the United Kingdom meddling in the affairs of foreign countries and major news outlets cooperating with them, abdicating their journalistic ethics and standards, as if they ever had any to begin with. Moreover, we see clearly once again how Silicon Valley, how all these tech giants and social media companies are just an extension of the government and a tool used to manipulate public opinion and control reporting that is adversarial to interests of the West. It's an extension of the national security state. Again, is it deplorable? Absolutely. Are we surprised? Not really. We know that these practices have been going on for decades since the Cold War. Regime change and propaganda, these are Britain and America's strong suits and a habit that they can't seem to kick. They continue these Cold War practices while pointing the finger at Russia and accusing Russia of the very same things that they decry. You couldn't find a stronger case of the pot calling the kettle black. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Richard Medhurst, and this is The Communique.
وقضى ربك ألا تعبدوا إلا إياه وبالوالدين إحسانا.
Your Lord has decreed that you shall not worship anyone except Him, and He has enjoined kindness to parents.
The first type of right that Imam Sajjad alayhi salam speaks about in his treatise is the right of God, the right of Allah, Haqqullah.
For humanity, a
commentary on Risalatul Huquq of Imam Sajjad alayhi salam.
In the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful. Dear brothers and sisters, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, and welcome to IRIB English Radio and the program for humanity. In this program, we were discussing one of the rights mentioned in the treaties of rights from Imam Ali ibn al-Husayn alayhim as-salam, Imam Zainul Abideen, the adornment of the believers. In that right, he mentions the right of him who seeks your advice, right number 39. In it, he says, and the right of him who seeks your advice is that you should exert all efforts to advise him if you can provide him with a good opinion, and suggest to him to choose what you would have chosen if you were in his shoes. You should do so with mercy and with lenience, since lenience will eliminate fear, while rudeness will eliminate friendliness. But if you do not have any good advice for him, you should refer him to someone else whom you know and trust his advice for yourself. You should spare no efforts to guide him towards the good and do your best to advise him. And there is no power but in Allah. Thus says Imam Ali Zainul Abideen alayhi salam. But what does the noble Quran and the riwayats, the narrations, the ahadith of the Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa sallam and the Imams alayhim salam say? Let's start with the noble Quran and make counsel with them in the affair. So when you have decided, then place your trust in Allah. Surely Allah loves those who trust. In another verse, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala describes the religious and faithful people in the following manner. And those who respond to the Lord, keep up prayer, who consult among themselves, and who give out to the poor part of what we have given them. Thus, both wisdom and narrations combine to indicate the sensitive position and the significance of consultation. It is better for Muslims to make use of this great Islamic command from Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, which is the very basis of prosperity and social improvement. Further, the Prophet used to advise people to have consultations among themselves. He himself made use of it frequently. And as I mentioned in previous programs, in the holy war of Badr, prior to his confrontation with the enemy, he consulted his followers. Tell me your views concerning the combat with Quraysh. Shall we advance? Shall we confront the enemy? Or shall we return back? The leaders of the Muhajireen, the immigrants, and the Ansar, the Prophet's close followers in Medina, presented two differing views. But the Prophet accepted that of the Ansar, which was the majority opinion, and that was to go out and meet the enemy outside the borders of the city. In the holy war of Badr, the elders believed that they must stay in Medina in order to defend the strongholds of the city by throwing arrows and stones from the strongholds. From the rooftops of their houses. But the youth, on the other hand, preferred confronting the enemy outside the borders of the city. The Prophet adopted the second opinion, which was the majority opinion. In the holy war of Khandaq, the war of the ditch, the Prophet convened a military council. He sought advice from the companions on what to do against an army of 10,000. And I will explain more about what the Prophet did after the break. So please join us afterwards.
This is Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Contact us at EnglishRadio@irib.ir.
Welcome back, dear brothers and sisters, to the program For Humanity. We were discussing the rights of him who seeks your advice from the treatise of rights of Imam Ali Zainul Abidin alayhi salam. In it, he said, you should do so when you seek advice. You should do so with mercy and with lenience, since lenience would eliminate fear, while rudeness would eliminate friendliness. And that's exactly what the Prophet did in one of the wars, which was called the War of Khandaq, the Ditch, where the Prophet, with lenience, seek the advice of the companions, and where the companions did not feel any fear to tell their opinion to the Prophet. And there you have it. When Imam Ali Zainul Abidin says, do so with mercy and with lenience, the companions of the Prophet felt that. They felt that they could tell their opinions without any fear to the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wa alihi wasallam. And in the holy war of Khandaq, the ditch, the Prophet convened a military council, and where he accepted the opinion and the advice of Salman al-Muhammadi sallallahu alayhi wa sallam, one of the greatest companions of the Prophet, and where Salman advised the Prophet to dig a ditch around the vulnerable areas of the city in around Medina, and the Prophet and the companions carried out his suggestion. In the holy war of Ta'if, the Prophet, in accordance with suggestions by some of the military officers, the companions changed the location of their headquarters. In the consultation sessions, it is common to express differing views. Each person tries to defend his own ideas according to his background and his expertise and his knowledge. And that is something very common. There must be a strong manager present who could gather all the different views and adopt the best of the views, or else such sessions would be fruitless. Incidentally, in the first verse which was revealed unto the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wa alihi wasallam on the issue of consultation or seeking advice, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says, فَإِذَا عَزَمْتَ فَتَوَكَّلْ عَلَى اللَّهِ. As soon as you have decided, rely on Allah. فَتَوَكَّلْ عَلَى اللَّهِ. The purpose of such an address is for the Prophet to realize that after consultation, after seeking advice, the only authority who should decide is the Prophet. He is the manager who must then in turn rely on Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. The leader of a group on whose instructions the consultation session convened would accept or decline the views of a third party which were better than his view. An example of such an act was the decision by the Prophet adopted in the peace treaty of Hudaybiyah. And I will inshallah talk more about the peace treaty of Hudaybiyah in coming programs. So please join us in coming programs where I will talk more about this right, the right of him who seeks your advice from Imam Ali Zainul Abidin alayhi salam. Please forward your questions to us or your suggestions through our email address, which is englishradio@irib.ir, and you can listen to us through parstoday.com. Till next time, may Allah's peace and blessings be upon all of you. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
رحمة أرسلته للعالمين وعلى آل النبي أجمعين فبهم نرجوك أحسن ختمنا.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en. This is IRIB.